Welcome back to Across the Movie Aisle, presented by Bulwark Plus. I am your host, Sonny Bunch, culture editor of The Bulwark. I'm joined, as always, by Alyssa Rosenberg of The Washington Post and Peter Suderman of Reason Magazine. Alyssa, Peter, how are you today?
I'm peachy keen.
I am happy to be talking about movies with friends.
First up in controversies and non-controversies, IATSE may be going on strike. What is IATSE? It's the International Alliance of Theatrical Stage Employees, and that's the union that represents so-called below-the-line talent. Everyone from grips to cinematographers, you know, if you work on a movie set, you've got a ton of these IATSE folks running around making sure that the movie looks good, the actors look good, the director has his coffee, and everything else. So they have voted to authorize a strike vote. They've not voted to strike. They've just authorized the ability to vote on a strike, which is one of these fun union bureaucratic things. Why did they do this? A whole bunch of reasons, but here are the two big ones. The first off is money. Everybody loves money. And the long and the short of the money situation is this. Many years ago, IATSE made a deal that allowed quote-unquote new media a break on things like residuals and other pay. Netflix and other streaming services were considered, at the time, new media. But now, Netflix is a service with annual revenue of around $25 billion. So the union, understandably, wants their proper share of the pie. It makes no sense for folks to get paid less on a Netflix production than they do on a Universal or Warner Brothers production. They want their money. But they're still working super long hours on Netflix or Hulu or HBO Max productions, just as they do on Warner Brothers or Universal productions, right? And this is the crux of the second real contentious issue, working conditions. Working conditions on movie and TV shows, on movies and TV shows, are notoriously brutal. There's long hours, there's few breaks. Early call times lead to very bad quality of life concerns. You're looking at like a 12-hour day being standard. 14 is more common, frankly, and 20 hours on set is not unheard of. So the big question then is where the money comes from, because if you reduce the number of hours that folks can work in a given day, you're going to have to spend a ton more money on production, because this is how productions work. You spend more money per day. It's essentially a daily thing, not an hourly thing, though this is also – there's some contention about this, about wage theft and that sort of thing. The question is, where's the money going to come from, right? As the Entertainment Strategy Guide noted in a recent edition of the Ankler newsletter, streamers aren't, strictly speaking, profitable, which means you can't really take a cut of the profits, which means that costs will get on passed on to the consumer. So, you know, this means maybe you're paying another dollar a month for Netflix or whatever. Or maybe we'll just see less stuff made overall. Alyssa, would that really be the worst thing in the world if there were simply fewer productions out there?
Honestly, no. I mean, we and I speak to a certain extent as a critic on this. It used to be possible for me to sit down and basically watch everything that was going to premiere at the beginning of a fall season. And now the idea of keeping up is just ludicrous. And a lot of the stuff that's being produced right now is meant to feed the streaming beast. It's just about churning out a lot of episodes, and a lot of it is just not very good. I was writing, and I think that, you know, we've seen this in the culture around television in particular as well, where there is so much churn that there are very few things that produce a sort of extended ongoing conversation. If you look at Google Trend searches for streaming shows versus some of the HBO classics or even, you know, FX shows that were popular, you'll see sharp spikes and then the interest falls off again almost immediately, which means that the streamers have to, or at least the streamers that are releasing things in sort of binge watching models, have to just churn out the next thing immediately. And, you know, I was writing a column about this phenomenon, the extent to which, you know, it was kind of a lonelier way to watch things, and the viewing environment has become very fragmented. And I asked Alan Sepinwall, who's the TV critic for Rolling Stone, you know, if I was wrong that the conversation had disappeared. And he said, yeah, and to a certain extent it's about streaming, but to a certain extent stuff just isn't good anymore, which is not to say there aren't good, interesting things being produced, but I'm not sure that the volume model has been, you know, a huge creative boon for pop culture. Yeah. And I would not mind if stuff consolidated a little bit. And even absent the question of an IATSE deal, I am not sure that this level of production is actually sustainable. you know, I think there has been this boom in streaming outlets because everyone wants to be in on that business. But I think the number of those outlets that are actually going to make it is definitely going to consolidate. I think we will see some cable channels fail, or at least contract, or, you know, go back to a model where they're running infinite Law and Order reruns rather than trying to program a full slate of programming. And so, you know, IATSE should get in while the getting is good, in part because I think that whatever they do, I do think we're going to see a contraction. There's just too much of this stuff. Not enough of it is good, and not enough of it is finding an audience.
Yeah. I mean, this is the thing, Peter, is that there is kind of a double-edged sword here for the folks at IATSE. I totally understand wanting better working conditions. You know, I've been on a handful of movie sets over the years, and, like, they work long-ass hours. They are, you know, driving home at, like, 3 in the morning sometimes, like, in situations that they, you know, they would say, and I would tend to agree, is not safe, just in terms of, like, falling asleep at the wheel. But also, I mean, if you reduce the number of hours, that's going to lead to longer production days in terms of number of days, which will lead to fewer productions overall, which means fewer jobs overall. I mean, it just, like, there will be fewer jobs for people who are working in the industry, right?
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. Fewer productions just means fewer jobs, period. And the people who are least well paid in many cases are these kind of below the line craftsmen who are who work incredibly hard, are quite talented, and they need a lot of work, right? Like they make their money off of volume in a lot of ways, and that will, if you reduce the number of productions, that is going to reduce the number of hours there are to get paid, and so that is going to that will affect the members of this union in some way, you know. And look, like you said, I get it in a lot of ways. The long hours they work are very hard, very arduous. I don't want to understate what it's like to work on those sets in those sorts of jobs in particular. But you also have to think about this a little bit from the producer and sort of director and kind of top of the line talent perspective, which is that they have extremely narrow windows to make these things. Even productions that have generous shooting schedules are really, they're done in ways, you know, on pretty tight schedules, because it's so expensive to get all of those people, not just the highly paid talent, but a lot of the sort of the mid-priced people, right? The grips making, you know, $15 or $20 or $25 an hour in some cases, right? And you get them on set for 10 or 14 hours, and it's just incredibly expensive to have all those people in the room at the same time. And you're there, you're the director or you're the actor, and you want time to make creative decisions. And so you just have to have people, the way that ends up working out is that in order for time for creative decisions to be made, is that people who are doing the hard work, you know, sort of the below the line labor, end up being there and needing to be there in some cases for very long periods of time. The other thing, though, that I want to sort of throw back to Alyssa a little bit. It's not just that fewer productions means fewer jobs. It's that if you end up with fewer productions and consolidation, it means that the things that are going to be cut from the production schedules are the niche targeted programs, the shows and movies that are risky. And in some cases, that's going to mean the sort of arty stuff that we all like, that we find really interesting, but is just not an obvious sell. And in many other cases, that's going to mean productions that check a lot of diversity boxes, right, that are made by and for people who are not guaranteed sale audiences, right? And so I think that you would probably end up with, if you had fewer productions, you would end up with a world in which the people who are most likely to get work are the people who already have strong records of selling to big audiences. And those aren't new faces. That's not new talent. That's the people who've already been doing it for a long time. So a smaller production slate empowers the people who are already successful and powerful. And consolidation ends up meaning that that companies that are successful or somewhat successful or continuing to do business, they end up moving towards something like the Disney model, where Disney simply produces stuff that they have a really, really, really good idea is going to work, and they don't produce a whole lot of stuff. Yes, there's the Disney Plus streaming boom, whatever, but like they're basically just focused on churning out the same thing over and over again, because that when you're trying to limit what you do, that's all you do is things you know will work rather than risky stuff that you don't know if it's going to actually, you know, earn out.
I agree. And I feel kind of dismal about it, even as I think it's sort of inevitable. Look, I mean, I wrote a series of pieces at the beginning of this content boom and as the streamers were becoming a bigger deal, arguing essentially that the nicheification of television in particular, and, you know, movies to a lesser extent through streaming, was going to solve the culture wars because everyone would have something that they liked. It would feel less like pop culture was a trade-off between, you know, cop shows and Master of None. And that is just one of the wrongest things I've ever written, right? I really wanted to believe that, and I found it kind of heartbreaking in the extent to which conversations about culture have gotten, in a lot of ways, stupider and more antagonistic.
I'm sorry, the culture war didn't end?
Yeah, it's crazy.
Just one last thought, Sunny. Like, you know, the stuff that is more diverse and interesting has not necessarily developed, you know, the kind of base and financial support stuff that I might have hoped from that experiment. And it's kind of depressing. When I talk about consolidation, you know, from a pure logistical schedule standpoint, it would be good for me to have slightly less stuff to wade through. I want media to be more interesting. The fact that I feel like this is inevitable is actually really heartbreaking and has been kind of devastating to my personal intellectual project. And that's hard.
Hey, all right, bummer.
Sunny's excited that everybody's depressed.
One avenue of the culture war that we haven't really talked about here that I have no pity for whatsoever are the fanboys who heard news of the possible IATSE work stoppage and were like, wait, hold on. If they go on strike so they don't have to work 16-hour days, does that mean I'm not going to get my comic book movies? Am I not going to get my Doctor Strange 2? And I was just like, you people are the worst in the world. Like, I like Marvel movies. I like to see big budget action adventure films. I like to go to them and talk about them with you guys. But if your first thought on this is, I'm going to not be able to see my post-credits stinger for Eternals 6, The Light of Galactus, or whatever the hell is going on out there. You are the enemy of everything to me. I cannot stand these. Am I wrong? Am I overreacting here,
yes.
Peter?
People should die at the wheel and get urinary tract infections so you can have your, because they're not allowed bathroom breaks, so you can have your goodies, clearly.
Sunny, why are you challenging me with that?
Well, you are the heartless capitalist. I assume you want them with the urinary tract infections and they have to take the speed so they can drive home, and then the downers so they can sleep for 2 hours, and then the speed so they can drive home again, right? That's like
you've
the libertarian ideal.
You have absolutely figured out libertarianism.
I've no
more succinct description of what libertarianism is has ever existed.
Excellent.
I think these are private sector unions, and in theory, right, all else being equal, people can band together to negotiate for their labor. That's not something that I oppose. I have some issues with some of the legal regimes around how unions are governed, but that's different than the idea that people in the private sector can be like, I'm going to only work with these people, and we're all going to negotiate together.
I meant more because you want your post-credit stingers. This wasn't a libertarianism.
Look, I'm just looking out for Alyssa here, because if these guys go on strike, it might be a long time before we see that She-Hulk TV series.
Good point.
You know, my solidarity with the working class, represented by IATSE, overcomes my desire for a She-Hulk TV show.
That's fair. All right, so what do we think? Is it a controversy or an controversy that IATSE could shut down all of Hollywood for a month or two while they sort this out? Alyssa?
It's a controversy and solidarity forever.
Peter?
It's a controversy.
I think it's a controversy, though this is the most sympathetic I've been to a Hollywood union in a very, very long time. And I say this as somebody who is, as the heartless right winger of this group, is generally not super sympathetic to unions. But I like the working conditions and the pay issue with the streamers. Like, Netflix is not the hero of any story, especially not this one. If you enjoy the show. And who doesn't? It's great. We work 16 hours at a whack to make this, just perfect for you guys.
We did come in on the weekend this time.
This is true. We're working on a Sunday to tape this, so you're going to peek behind the curtains. Make sure to head over to atma.thebulwark.com, where we're going to talk about a special, very important topic on our bonus episode, which Bond is best? Speaking of Bond, on to the main event, No Time to Die. This is Daniel Craig's final adventure as James Bond. We'll get to spoilers in a minute, but this is definitely the final Daniel Craig James Bond. In this conclusion to the quintet of films he has made, things get started, he is trying to celebrate his new life with his love, Madeline, played by Lea Seydoux, and gets blown up for his efforts, and thus starts a big adventure trying to figure out what's going on with Spectre. And tying everything together. Again, we'll get to spoilers in a minute, but I have one big problem with this movie, and that is that I have no idea what Rami Malek's Safin, why he wants to kill millions of people. So as the movie starts, he is essentially trying to wipe out Spectre for his own reasons. Good for him. Everybody hates Spectre. And there's a whole like flip side of the same coin with James Bond. Who's actually the hero here? What methods work? That's all kind of interesting. And then for no reason whatsoever, in the last hour of the movie, Rami Malek Safin is trying to kill like a million people, like billions of people. He's just trying to wipe out everyone. There's no line of dialogue anywhere in the film that explains any of this. I'm very confused. I'm very, very confused. There was early rumblings that he was an environmentalist, and he was like kind of a typical Malthusian, wanted to reduce the population of the world. But that's nowhere in this film. And part of me wonders if they may have cut that. Because some jerk is out there talking about how environmentalists are good villains all the time. I don't know. Maybe. It's possible. So anyway, that's a problem with the movie. And as for the series as a whole, it's kind of at war with itself. The first two movies in the series, Casino Royale and Quantum of Solace, were very much almost anti-Bond, James Bond films. They were making fun of things like Moneypenny. They were making fun of the whole shaken, not stirred thing. They were used for like punchlines. And then in the last three movies, all of these things come back with a vengeance. There is an actual Moneypenny character. There's Q. There's cars with ejector seats and all that sort of stuff. Funny gadgets. Crazy wild adventures. There are vodka martinis shaken, not stirred. It goes back to the roots of the series, which again, I don't mind because it's not like I hate James Bond or anything, but it feels like a rejection of what they were doing for the first two movies of this series. Again, the whole thing feels kind of at war with itself. Here are some things I really liked about this movie. Number one, first and foremost, is Ana de Armas. Her like 25-minute interlude in Cuba with Daniel Craig as they are having like kind of a crazy adventure where they're embedded into a Spectre party and then things go sideways was delightful. I find Ana de Armas exceptionally amusing, especially in her enthusiastic mode, shall we say. She's like all wide eyes and like puppy dog energy. It's very endearing. I love her in this. I love her in most things, frankly. And I love Angry Bond. I love Daniel Craig looking like he wants to put his fist all the way through people when he is fighting them. Like, he is like the angriest I've ever seen a person on screen when he is in a fist fight. And what's interesting about this series of movies is that they feel like we just spent a bunch of time talking about prestige TV. But these movies feel like a reflection of prestige TV in the way that earlier films in the series felt like a reflection of the Cold War or the post-Cold War era, right? Like, it's a weird thing to think of these movies less as products of international intrigue and more of, like, well, what's going on with the state of the industry? As such, there were two possible endings for this set of films. The first was James Bond riding off into the sunset with his girl, which is basically how Spectre ends. That's the literal end of Spectre. He's riding off into the sunset. He's going to get married and have a fun life and whatever. And then there's James Bond engaging in spoilers. Again, so if you haven't seen it, you want to go see it, go see it. But the other way to end this series is to have James Bond engaging in a noble sacrifice to save the world and his loved ones, which is what happens at the end of No Time to Die. I prefer this, frankly. I thought this ending was wonderful. It's the sort of ending that only really works, though, because they have done something in this movie that they've never done in another James Bond film, which is give him a kid. It gives him a reason beyond mere duty to make the ultimate sacrifice and feels more powerful as a result. So I liked this a lot. I feel like this is a mildly controversial opinion. People seem very mixed on it, but it all worked for me, honestly. Peter, what did you make both of this film and the way it kind of wrapped up Daniel Craig's Bond in general?
So I liked this movie quite a bit. I didn't quite love it. I think it has some issues, in particular with the villains, like you said. I'll start with what I liked. It just looks great. Unlike so many of the blockbusters that we have watched over the last year, in particular this summer, which just sort of have this pixelated, animated feel to them. They don't feel real in any sense, and they're not even necessarily supposed to. This movie just sort of has a great physicality to it. Of course, part of that is Daniel Craig himself, but just the craft work, the design, the production design on this movie, it looks and feels really great. And so it's just a pleasure to watch and to look at. The action scenes are really crackling. I mean, there's a number of just excellent set pieces that you could watch almost without the context of the rest of the movie. The bit at the end of the second act in particular, where he's sort of moving through the woods and everything's kind of, got that greenish, foggy tint to it. It's just so perfectly moody. And the movie has a bunch of scenes like that just really work. And so visually, it's just a delight and one of the better blockbusters I've seen from a visual craft perspective recently. I think this movie does have these villain issues that you were talking about. I also had no idea what Rami Malek's plan was or why he wanted to kill people. I suspect that there was some last minute editing. Director Cary Joji Fukunaga, who co-wrote this movie, has said that they were literally still writing the screenplay while they were doing the edit on it, and that they had him, that during the production, they had people shoot lines that were designed to pay off for multiple different possible endings because they didn't know how the movie was going to end. And so they would say, hey, Ralph Fiennes, say this sort of foreboding thing that doesn't actually mean anything. We'll figure out how it fits into the movie later. And Ralph Fiennes would be like, okay, whatever. And then he'd be like, this is the most important decision of your life, Bond. And they'd like work it in somehow. So I do think that there's like some muddledness there. And it's not just that Rami Malek doesn't have a plan. It's that the movie doesn't actually want to commit to Rami Malek's villain. What it wants is for all of Bond's signatures to be the bad guys here in some sense, or at least to be the antagonists in this film, because this is a movie that is a kind of a reckoning about with Bond's legacy, right? And so MI6 and Bond's women and Bond's harsh, his ways and his violence are the subject of this movie. And so I think it was in some ways a mistake to have the Rami Malek character, who's a very traditionalist Bond villain, with a lair and a plot to kill everybody at the very end and like a weird face and a mask and whatever,
and all these poison, like, kind of, island.
Right? Yes, all of these
poison island.
All of these kind of throwback Bond ticks in a movie that, at its best, is about Bond facing off against himself and all of the bad shit that he has done throughout his life, and then is kind of punished for it. Because what is the ultimate punishment for a serial misogynist womanizer? It's that he does find love late in his life, and then he is separated from his woman forever and has to die for the spy agency that screwed something up that he has, you know, spent his life working for.
I would just like to note that Rami Malek was born to play a disfigured, insane Bond villain. His whole look is like, okay, yeah, no, this all he makes sense now to me. His place in the universe makes sense.
He looks cool, and he makes the most of a completely underwritten role. But I don't think the role as written makes any sense.
Makes no sense. I disagree. Well, Alyssa, let's talk about this a little bit, because I want to get your take on this. I find the first part of Safin's story to make a lot of sense. He wants to get rid of Spectre. Boom. Makes sense. Why is he trying to kill the world in the second part? Explain this to me. Somebody explain this to me.
I have no idea. I'm sorry. I have no idea at all.
Because Thanos.
It's because they need MI6's decision to develop this weapon to turn out to have been really bad and dangerous and misguided. Because in addition to this being a five-movie series that's focused on Bond himself, it's a five-movie series about the corruption and decline of the British Empire as represented by its intelligence services.
Yep.
Rami Malek has no reason to want to kill the world. I'm sorry. I have nothing for you there.
Okay. Well, what did you make of the movie overall? What was your general take on it?
It's interesting. I mean, I think like both of you, I agree that it has a huge villain problem. It is interesting the extent to which both Lucifer, whatever his name is, and the idea of Bond having a kid are very borrowed from You Only Live Twice. I don't know if either of you have read any of the Fleming novels, but that one also involves Bond literally having like a showdown with a villain at a poison island, getting amnesia, and ending up like living in, I think, a Japanese fishing village and having no idea who he is and having like knocked up a local village lady who sort of hopes that he's going to stick around when obviously he's not. But I thought this was absent. I mean, excusing that major problem with the movie, I thought this was quite an effective end to the, sort of argument that these movies are making effectively. Quantum of Solace is kind of an outlier here because it doesn't really play with the ideas about the state of the empire as much. But, in Casino Royale, Bond is getting accredited to serve in this institution. In Skyfall, it's clearly vulnerable. In Spectre, it's capable of manipulation. And then in No Time to Die, the institution is making world-threatening mistakes, and Bond dies both to, sort of cut that off and cover them up. And it's a heroic death, but it's also a tragic and a stupid one, right? It's, he is killed because his bosses made a terrible, short-sighted, incredibly dangerous decision. And there is something that is sort of low-key about the way that M and his colleagues send him off at the end. It's like, well, it's back to work. And you're left thinking, well, is that so good? Like, how is that going to work out for anybody? Is this worth work worth doing? And I thought it worked quite well in that regard. I realize we haven't talked about Lashana Lynch's 007 at all. And while Ana de Armas is totally delightful in this, and specifically a totally delightful riff on the sort of wide-eyed Bond girl in a way. I mean, her sort of playing the ditz, like, I've had 3 weeks training. Then, in fact, proving to be like incredibly competent. Is a lot of fun. But I also thought Lynch was a really interesting presence in this movie, in part because they give her and sort of let her express some of the same kind of masculinity and edge that Craig himself does as Bond, right? I mean, she is not styled, when we see her in that scene in, Jamaica, Cuba. I forget exactly when it is that she shows up. You know, she's sort of dressed up. She's in a crop top. She has long, you know, she has a wig that makes it look like she has long hair. But then once she's back in her own clothes, you know, she's very covered up. They are giving her strong sort of 80s referential shoulder pads. And she's, you know, she is herself, you know, strong and muscular. You know, they have her flying the experimental plane with Bond. They give her sort of sharp sunglasses. And I thought it was an interesting, you know, it's an interesting performance, in part because the way she's written is she's kind of needling Bond about the fact that it must bother her that she's 007. You know, it's, they actually have her, you know, like kill off this treacherous scientist who she's been trying to extract and bring in, but she just, like, she goes off the edge after he finally tries to goad her by being racist. And it's not overboard on the, you know, this is what a black female Bond would be like. But it's an interesting enough performance that, though I am very skeptical of the idea that making Bond either black or a woman would be much of a genuine blow for equality in Hollywood, that I would be specifically interested to see a movie with her as 007, if not her as, like, James Bond, per se. I thought she was very good.
Yeah, she's very interesting, and in some ways, I think, underused in the film. Not that she's not there and not that the bits with her don't work, but, you know, this is what I was saying about the movie's villain problem. It's not just that Rami Malek doesn't have a plan. It's that the movie is just not all that interested in the traditional villain with a big plan. The movie is, at its best, interested in making Bond face off against what are you sort of the way the world has changed around him. Right. And she is in one of the clearest and most marked symbols of that. And in some ways, this is, you know, this is the producers and the filmmakers responding to these years and years of calls for a James Bond who isn't, you know, a middle-aged white guy. And it's really interesting because I think we got something that is better than that, at least for now, which is that we got to see how Bond himself would react to a Bond type, another 007. I mean, she literally inherits his signifier. And to me, that's actually a more interesting movie and a more interesting way to address the critics of, oh, it's just white guy Bond. And I think it really works. And it's one of the best ideas in the film.
Yeah, what's really interesting about it to me is that Bond doesn't care.
Yeah.
Bond does not care that she's a black woman who is 007, which I thought was, it's funny. This weekend I happened to watch The Enforcer, which is one of the Dirty Harry movies. It's the third Dirty Harry movie, and he gets a lady cop partner. And the whole movie is like Dirty Harry being like, ugh, a lady cop partner, you know, oh, she's a woman, she's not fast enough or strong enough or
it's
whatever.
It's like the first episode of What If?
Kind of. And by the end of it, there's this moment where, like, the filmmakers have a choice. They can either have the lady cop save the day or they can have her killed, essentially, because she's an incompetent woman. And they kill her because she's an incompetent woman. No. It's like actually kind of amazing. It's a very interesting look into a very different time. What's really interesting about a Bond in No Time to Die is that he just does not care. He's just like, ah, whatever. You're a lady. You're trying to goad me into a reaction here, and I'm not going to give it to you because I don't give a damn.
But it's also an interesting sort of way of expressing Bond's sophistication, right? That he is not bothered by that at all, and also just to a certain extent his contempt and alienation from the agency. But yeah, I mean, look, I wrote a column about this, I think, 5 years ago before Daniel Craig, you know, recent remarks about whether there should be a female Bond or whatever. And the thing is, James Bond is an exploration of white British masculinity of a certain class, right? Like, that's literally what the character is. And it's something that this franchise has managed extremely well. You have that sort of initial meeting between Bond and Vesper Lynd on the train in Casino Royale, where she sort of picks up on some cues about his education, but also his class relationship to the educational environment that he came up in. You have it again in Skyfall when you see him in the context of this sort of moldering British estate with Kincaid, the gamekeeper. And so, you know, you can tell a story about what it means to be Black and British. That's really interesting. And in fact, Steve McQueen did that in his Small Axe series of films this summer. You can tell really interesting stories about what it means to be female and British. And that's to a certain extent what The Crown has been doing lately. But those are not James Bond stories. And it is totally okay to have stories that are about this, you know, particular state of being. And I think actually what I find quite compelling about Daniel Craig's run as James Bond is how much they've sort of leaned into that idea and made it explicit and played with it and, you know, looked at some of the tension between modernity and, you know, and the tradition that this is part of, between, you know, what kind of adapts well about Bond's brand of masculinity, what doesn't, et cetera. You know, Peter and I were talking about Javier Bardem's performance in Skyfall. And, you know, it's interesting that you have a series of villains, you know, Le Chiffre, you have this sort of focus on like sexually annihilating torture. In Skyfall, you have a gay or at least sort of bisexual villain kind of coming on to Bond and the implication that maybe Bond has been there before. You have the sort of clearer explanation in this movie that Q is gay. You have a, you know, more masculinized female character in the form of Lashana Lynch's character. And so the, you know, the franchise has handled that deftly without letting it take over the movies. And I have just found them more intellectually engaging than pretty much any other blockbuster, you know, franchise that has been running contemporaneously. It is a really nice set of movies in illustrating just how you can make a smart popcorn film that doesn't, you know, where those ingredients don't upset or offset each other at all. I just think it's really nicely done.
I agree, though. I think the trade-off with this series is that the lore doesn't entirely sort of hold together. This series, I think Sonny is not totally wrong to say that this series started off as a deconstruction of Bond, went two films in and was like, wait, let's bring back some of the signatures. Right. There is some continuity here, right? I mean, in particular, this film, I think, is the most continuity heavy Bond film probably ever. You know, in that it looks back from the beginning to Casino Royale and then also picks up directly after Spectre left off. But the trade-off here in making films that are a little more, I think, as you said, intellectually and culturally engaged, is that there's a lack of consistency. And some of these movies are definitely better than others. You know, and Quantum of Solace, I think, is really quite a weak film in a lot of ways, although I've softened on it a little bit since it came out. But it's not a great movie.
Yeah. Well, the problem with the Quantum of Solace is that it's a 100-minute epilogue to Casino Royale. It's just like tying up a bunch of loose ends. And that movie already had like a 20-minute epilogue. I mean, it's a very unnecessary and weird movie, frankly. All right, so what do we think? On No Time to Die, thumbs up or thumbs down? Alyssa?
Thumbs up.
Peter?
Thumbs up.
Thumbs up. Three thumbs up. Everybody should go see it. All right, that is it for today's show. If you loved it, make sure to check out our members-only bonus episode on which Bond is best. Make sure to tell your friends. Strong recommendation from a friend is basically the only way to grow podcast audiences. If you don't grow, we'll die. If you did not love today's episode, please complain to me on Twitter @SunnyBunch. I'll convince you that it is, in fact, the best show in your podcast feed. See you guys again next week.